What's that in the back behind you?
You mean, I saw it myself. It's an old, you see the instrument up there. What is it called? Balafon from
Gambia.
Oh,
it's a balafon. Okay. Yeah. I think maybe I saw bigger ones than that.
Yeah. Before. They are in many sizes. Mm. And there's probably some dust on it between you and me. I haven't used it for several years.
Yeah. Did you use it on recording once?
Way back, I think so, yes.
Which recording?
Which recording could that have been? I can hardly remember. I have to meditate over this. I was about to say an old album I did called Jord, which is Earth, but I'm not really sure if that's the one. But I have used it somewhere, sometime. Yeah.
Nice. Where did you get it? And how?
I got it from a friend who got it from Gambia, I think. I did play way back a little with African musicians staying in Sweden. So in connected to that, I was given this as a gift from someone.
How's it tuned?
So that's the story. I like to collect instruments. I am now in the living room in my small flat in town, but otherwise I have in my music studio lots of instruments, trumpets, clarinets, you know, everything.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Do you also own a koto?
No, I don't.
We have to get a koto for you.
Yes, we do.
But like, because I'm asking because... Is there a special thing that you have to understand about the koto when you write for it?
Yes, I feel so. When the collaboration, I think you're referring to my collaboration with the koto player Karin Nakagawa from Japan. And when we decided to work together, I realized I have to learn how this instrument works, simply. What can it do? What can it almost do or not do? And what can it absolutely not do? And then stretch the limits to see, in this case, coming from Western Europe, we are used to chromaticism, while that is not part of the Japanese traditional music. So how can we meet there? So I asked directly in our process to get some knowledge, some books or some instructions, videos or whatever from Karin. So she sent from Japan a very good instruction film for the Japanese classical tradition, koto, but all with Japanese texts and explanations, the Japanese signs. So I didn't understand very much, but I could see and learn. And the first times we met, I curiously asked and checked out what is possible and how to reach the limits and therefore the new possibilities on an instrument. Always when I write, I try to learn, at least to some extent, how the instrument actually works. In Western music, we can talk about the modern harp, for example, which is really tricky when you try to compose for it. What can it do? What can it not do? And what precautions do you have to make? In this case, to retune with the pedals, you need some time, blah, blah, blah. And each instrument have those challenges. You cannot bend notes on a piano, for example. And you have to know that. As a composer, all of us know about piano, but when you come far away from your own previous experience, you need to study a little. At least I do. I like it.
It's a nice process.
It is. And you could possibly say that not knowing too much about an instrument will make you write things almost impossible, and that's how technique on that instrument have developed. I'm thinking of the violin, for example, how every 50th year it comes in a piece impossible to play. Finally, one musician take her or his time to learn it. And 25 years later, three people in each city can play this piece.
Yeah.
Stretching the new horizons.
Mm-hmm. And always when you write something for a new, or from my experience also, like if I write something for a new instrument that I haven't really, where I don't really know as much in going into it, it also tells you something about your instrument or your perception of music.
True.
So how was that with the koto and the bass?
That's a very good question. I think I have tried to make the koto sound more, should we say, singing, ringing. I have tried to inspire vibrato and things, which is definitely part of the traditional koto technique, but still not used in the way we do, to give life to a single note. And how has it affected my playing? Maybe something you can definitely be inspired of playing with and studying koto is the clarity of each note.
Oh, yeah.
There is no means of misunderstanding what is played. There is no muddy dimensions. It's crystal clear, which means a koto player has to be extremely convinced, because the instrument makes everything you do shine. And if you are in doubt, this doubt will shine instead of projection and conviction in music. And maybe this has, or will, or is inspiring me. I haven't considered this, but I think you're very, very right that when we play with a new instrument or with a experienced strong musician, we do learn. What we learn, we may possibly understand 10 years later.
Absolutely. We could get into so many of the masters that you,
yes,
that you talked to and played with. But I kind of want to stay a little bit with the koto and with that special combination, because there's not really a question, but I just thought that the combination that you chose for this particular, this last album, so
Passado en Claro.
Yes, yeah, so incredibly clear, but rich in colors. And also, in a way, we all love piano and bass, but the what the koto brings to you is an environment and beautiful sounds, but also it gives you so much space to play.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think you have a good point there. The space given through this, the clarity of the koto, and the fact that the instrument cannot provide those wonderful big chords that a gifted pianist can do. So this space given by the koto challenges me as a bass player to be more clear and more, should we say, advanced when it comes to bring out the harmony of the piece, because the koto itself cannot do. If I play only the bass note, which I can do if we play a duo, no one will hear what chord is intended. So this partly affects my writing, having a melody note, one or two koto notes, and my own note, which gives me three or four notes that, through voice leading, etc., etc., shall produce a chord progression which no one, no single musician plays, but it should be the result of what we play. Plus the fact that I feel I have to play more rich, or should we say complex, not only the bass note, in order to bring out the harmony that I imagine in a piece.
You and play like sound. A composer, in a way, yeah. And also yeah. like a pianist or guitarist at the bass.
Okay, yeah, thank you. I take it as a compliment.
Oh, it is a compliment.
yes, I guess I do. I think...
Your role changes in this environment, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Absolutely. And playing with a pianist gifted and skilled in harmony, I may play in a different way. So that's a kind of general statement I always bring with me. What does music need from me?
Mm.
And we both know that sometimes it needs very much, but very often it doesn't need so very much. Mm. Sometimes the best thing I can bring is my silence, the choice of a pause to make the rich sound of the piano come through. And there is no necessity of my contribution in that very moment or sequence. But when I compose for the koto and for a voice and percussion, there is room for me, and there is possibly need for me also.
Mm. Yeah, beautiful. Thank you for checking out this episode. If you enjoy these conversations, please consider joining me on patreon.com/pabloheld. My Patreon community helps me to pay for the running costs of this podcast and to develop it further into the future. There's two ways to join me there. The interview tier will give you access to lots of behind-the-scenes content. And also, you get every episode before everybody else gets, so that's early access to episodes. The other option is the music lessons tier, which will give you everything from the interviews tier, plus two video lessons on different topics each month, lead sheets, so whenever I transcribe a new song, you'll get it first. You'll be invited to listening sessions and much more. So these are two options for you to join me there. By doing that, you will be helping me to continue this podcast. So thank you, and let's get back to the episode. The way you are fluent on the instrument in terms of technique, but also in terms of notes, voice leading, harmonic choices.
Mm.
I'm wondering, do you remember starting with the bass and wishing for this ability, like dreaming about this ability and dreaming about when I would be able to finally play mm-hmm. what I hear, I would like to play like this, you know? Do you remember this?
Not really. I cannot really remember having a wish to reach somewhere far away. I started as a pianist, like you.
Mm.
And I shouldn't say that I became a good piano player, but I came far enough to understand the phenomena of voice leading, how chords work and how they can be created and put together. So when playing a bass, I think I have not done it with the typical bass player's state of mind. I played bass with the pianist's state of mind.
Yeah.
Probably. And also, since I loved composing music, you know, just putting together a melody and three chords from childhood. So I think I also have this composer's approach to music, the result, the overall look to music. So I don't see bass as a special instrument. I see the band as my instrument, and I try to contribute with whatever I can and feel is needed from the instrument I have, in this case bass. And funny story, some people ask me, why did you choose bass? And I can say, partly joking, but it's also true. I didn't choose it. My father chose it because he was a jazz piano player and needed a duo partner.
Yeah,
at home.
Yeah,
we played standards in the basement of our small flat, more or less every evening, as I can remember it. So I learned the 2-5-1 language from childhood, and was, well, let's say, inspired to play the bass at early age. Should I have chosen when I was 17 or 18, I think I would have chosen piano, cello, trumpet, like Miles Davis.
Mm-hmm.
I would never dare to sing, but I would love to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So bass has not been the love of my life. It has just been there in my hands.
Yeah.
And also, I talk very much now, but
you
inspire
have to.
Me.
It's your interview.
That's what it's about. When I started the music academy to study music, I entered as a pianist.
Mm.
You know, Pathetic Sonata. And some jazz or whatever I did at the entrance exams. I also had bass as a second instrument. And that bass teacher was so encouraging to me. He said, yeah, this is your thing. So
what did you play for
teacher
him?
Well, I think that was jazz bass studies.
Yeah.
As my second instrument, because I could choose the second instrument. So what did we play? I can hardly remember, but that was my first steps into more modern jazz than the jazz I had played with my father. So
mm-hmm.
simply my bass teacher encouraged me so much that after 1 year in the music academy, I asked to change my first instrument from piano to bass. And that's how it has proceeded from there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a choice of mine, finally. But mm-hmm. I'm so interested in many other instruments. And I can mention some bass heroes, of course. But I think I have learned very much in music, in jazz music and other kinds of music, from other instrumentalists besides bass.
Mm. How about your father? How was he as a teacher teaching you songs?
Well, he is not alive anymore. He was mainly just... He didn't teach me very much. He didn't know very much. He couldn't read music, but he knew chords.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere I got it there, and I listened to records very much as a child. I think the piece in jazz history that I've heard most times is, I think you know this, Billy Boy with mm-hmm. Red Garland Trio on an extra piece from the Milestones album
yeah.
with Miles Davis.
Yeah.
There's one piece with only trio.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the best piece I knew from,
yeah.
let's say, the age of 5 to 10.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know everything by heart.
Beautiful.
And that bowing solos by Paul Chambers and those fours played by Philly Joe. I heard it was fantastic, but I couldn't count.
Yeah.
I couldn't understand what was happening. But I vaguely remember sometime, let's say I was 14 or 15, when I suddenly got it.
Mm-hmm.
I understood what yeah. he was doing.
Yeah, that's a nice feeling, huh?
It's a very nice feeling.
Yeah,
that doesn't happen too often now when we are old, experienced, well-studied, have an academic understanding of very, very much.
Mm-hmm.
This total... I don't understand anything, but it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, wow, now I get it.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's a little sad part about it, that we lose the mystery a bit.
Mm-mm.
But
true.
The more we stick to it, there's new mysteries within
absolutely.
That thing that come back.
That's like getting deeper, is getting further into the mystery that
right.
we think we have embraced. Mm.
When was the last time you listened to Billy Boy?
Oh, very good question. That's some time ago now, yeah. But whenever I listen to it, shit, this is great.
Yeah.
I feel
yeah.
It still talks to a certain part of my heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's very swinging, isn't mm-hmm. it?
Oh, yeah.
And then later in life, I got slightly surprised that this is actually a cover mm-hmm. of Ahmad Jamal.
Yeah.
It's surprisingly close mm-hmm. to an original piano arrangement by Ahmad Jamal, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. I wonder how, because I think Miles told Red Garland a lot about how to play and what to do and to copy a little bit from the Ahmad Jamal perspective.
This I didn't know.
And maybe it also made it up, but I think there was also some kind of little fallout between them, or Red Garland sometimes being like, okay, enough of that, you know.
Okay.
So I wonder how the feeling of Red Garland towards Ahmad Jamal actually was.
Yeah, that's a good question. This I haven't heard or read anything about, actually. And I've
maybe I'm completely wrong. I don't know. Yeah.
Well,
it's
just on
my mind. I don't know.
There is so many stories, or is it myths, around how Miles Davis inspires or instructs his musicians. And it's very difficult to know how much. I have often imagined that one part of the greatness of Miles Davis was that he managed to put together bands where he didn't have to instruct the musicians, because they had their own thing. But this is just my imagination of a good leader putting together musicians who you don't have to tell how to play.
Mm-hmm.
But if he now told Red Garland some things, that can be possible.
Have
but
you
do
heard
we
the...
know if Miles Davis could play piano himself? Do we know that?
I think he could, yeah.
Okay.
I think he learned it because Dizzy Gillespie told him to learn the piano
okay.
to get the bigger perspective of the music. Mm. I just read the biography of Dizzy, which was very revealing.
Yeah.
And he's like all about, you have to play piano. It's the most important thing.
Yeah.
And that's also what Freddie Hubbard says. Like, he says, like, everything that I can play on the trumpet, it's a little bit exaggerated maybe, but everything that he can play on the trumpet, he can play on the piano, and he can only play it on the trumpet because he can play it on the piano.
Oh.
Stuff like that. So
yeah,
and also with Ahmad Jamal, the influence of Ahmad Jamal on Miles is very interesting to me, because I went back and checked out all the recordings that Miles probably would have heard, and you see many similarities in the repertoire, in the pieces. Mm-hmm. And then also in the arrangements. And like, if you go back to Miles Ahead, you see like Gil Evans arranging old versions of Ahmad Jamal's thing, you know.
Well, this is, it's not a total surprise to me, but very interesting that you say this, because we very seldom hear in jazz education or jazz schools that Miles Davis was like all the rest of us, influenced by other musicians. Mm. He is often presented as a genius, not needing to be influenced by anything at any time.
Nobody is like that, I think. I think everybody
is
the product of their influences, and may it be conscious influences and all the stuff that influences us, which we don't know about, which we maybe dig up later, then we see, because sometimes we see this thing, you listen to Billy Boy all your life, and after decades you find out, he's actually playing the version of Ahmad Jamal in a way, you know. That's interesting.
It is, and it's also kind of rewarding what you say here, that you believe that Ahmad Jamal was a main influence for Miles Davis. That's a very good thing, because it leads us to listen also to what happened before Miles and see the connection.
Yeah,
I often feel Miles is presented as an island of a genius, not being influenced by anyone, having invented everything himself, which we realize cannot be true. But I never heard this clear statement like you present here, that Ahmad Jamal, that's a main influence. That's partly news to me. Great.
Mm-hmm. Here's a theory that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the music that you do is so special and so unique, and very, or let's just say it how I feel it. Like, I have the feeling that Jaco Pastorius is a big, important person for you.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
That's true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, and that's what I love about the phenomenon of influences and being influenced by somebody. Because when I listen to your symphony, Billy Boy is the last thing that I think of.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Oh.
You know, and also in a way, although I always get the feeling like I want to ask him about Jaco. Mm-hmm. Your music is so different.
Yeah.
But I hear an aesthetic and a harmonic view, and also sometimes I think of Hejira, the way Jaco plays behind Joni Mitchell. Mm-hmm. Although he's comping, he's like right up front there with her.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get your view on this, and I'm very interested what you think.
You are totally right. Jaco was a big influence to me, and it was a, I find actually I have spent, I really try to play melodic, that's one of my main ambitions, and I think Jaco is one of the bass players who have been able to play the strongest melodies, the most beautiful phrases. So he has inspired me not only as a bass player, but the fact that I find very much of his soloing so melodically interesting. And we know that his favorite musician was maybe Toots Thielemans,
mm-hmm.
who is another phenomena in melodicism, especially when it comes to dominant seven chords,
mm-hmm.
where I think Toots is the master. And Toots has also been very, not influential in the meaning that I have copied everything he does, not at all, but I've been knocked out every time I hear him play a harmonica solo. Wow, fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I think it is the distance to Jaco as an electric bass player is far enough for me to be influenced and try to learn, for example, the art of using harmonics, which is Jaco's specialities. But trying to do them on the double bass, finding some things are too tricky, some things are maybe even easier, blah, blah. But like you, let's say, as a pianist, to be inspired by church organ, that distance is long enough to be able to do your own thing out of it.
Yeah.
While if you copy your favorite piano player, there is always a risk that you become a copy or too close. So Jaco has been a strong influence. And then, maybe, believe it or not, Charlie Hayden and mm-hmm. Gary Peacock, they are my two bass heroes. And I think I do not sound too close to them, but
yes.
My God, how they have inspired me
mm-hmm.
with the putting all the essence in one note, like Charlie Hayden, the minimalism taken to its extreme, still having the full meaning of musical content, and Gary Peacock for his trying to play fantastic things.
That's a good way to put it. It's beautiful. Mm. He's reaching for stuff.
He's reaching for things beyond his capacity, but he dares to do it, which is a real challenge for an improviser, to dare to try what you have not done before, what you cannot or have not prepared. And especially when your music is more open in form, you have no idea where this will lead you. You're just taking a big step out into the unknown. And there, Gary Peacock is a major influence.
Mm.
And gestures rather than pre-practiced phrases.
Yeah.
That's inspiring.
Mm-hmm. When you think of Gary Peacock, what album comes to mind right away?
Trio 64 with Bill Evans. Have you heard that?
Yeah, I was just thinking of that.
Totally freaked out bass playing. I say this with the biggest respect
yeah.
for one of my main influences. But what a daring and inspired music he does on the bass.
Mm-hmm.
With no respect to excellence, but with full belief that jazz is a music supposed to lead somewhere.
Mm.
That, I think, is inspiring.
Yeah.
Maybe I exaggerate a little, but I look upon Gary Peacock as the not perfect bass player trying to show the way.
Mm-hmm.
And besides that, his walking bass is fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
With the Keith Jarrett's trio mm-hmm. recordings that I really admire.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to talk to him?
Yes. I wouldn't say we were close friends, but we have met many times. And when he played in Sweden, he often wanted to use one of my basses. And we have been playing duo in back rooms in festivals a couple of times.
Oh, nice.
I, of course, told him that, ooh, you're my big hero.
Yeah.
And yeah, I like you, blah, blah, blah. So I got to know him a little, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you ask him questions about your favorite albums or
no,
musicians?
Not really. Mm-hmm. Not really. Just giving him my compliments, and playing duo a little,
mm-hmm.
exchanging some bass talk. I cannot really remember any details, but I can see how we were standing in some back rooms waiting to play.
Nice.
With different constellations.
Beautiful.
Mm.
Did you meet Jaco?
Only on distance. Unfortunately, when he, as we know, he had some problems with drugs. I have actually seen him also in back rooms behave pretty bad, unfortunately. But I can easily separate this from the great music he did.
Mm.
What
was the first thing that you heard of Jaco?
I think, I am not sure, but I guess it was his first solo album, Donna Lee. Or maybe it wasn't called Donna Lee.
It's called Jaco Pastorius, but Donna Lee is the first track.
Mm-hmm. I think that was the first. Probably someone showed me, have you heard this? Blah, blah, blah. And then I'm also a Weather Report fan. That was influential to me.
Mm-hmm.
And there you got more of Jaco.
Oh, yeah.
When he was, should we say, inspired and balanced with other geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
What a band.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Personalities. Big personalities.
Oh, yeah. Strong personalities.
Mm-hmm. And how about Charlie Hayden? Did you meet him?
I have also said hello to him, yes. But not more than that. I've seen him live also a couple of times.
And is there an album that you think of right away when you when
With
Charlie Hayden?
Charlie Hayden, well, he did two duo albums that came pretty close in time. Can't remember for what label, but there is one where he plays duo with. Keith Jarrett, among others, and Ornette,
oh, yeah.
And Alice Coltrane.
Closeness.
One, Closeness, and the other album, I think, is called Forturaya. Is it right?
I think that's a song on Closeness.
Okay, so you know everything. But Closeness,
I don't know.
Yes. And then, isn't there another duo album? Or are we talking about the same? Closeness, anyway. That's a great
album, I think. Closeness
album, I
is
think.
Keith Jarrett. Ornette, Alice Coltrane,
Ornette.
And maybe Paul Motion.
Paul Motion, yeah.
Could that be true?
But is it also Alice Coltrane, or is that the next duo album?
She's on Closeness, but
okay.
I'm not
yeah.
sure if she's also on another duo album. I wouldn't.
I am. This is. We are talking history. That's not my. I mean, my personal history is not my strongest subject. I tend to forget everything. But this is a really good album. And,
oh,
of
yeah.
course, everything he did with Jarrett,
mm-hmm.
I have heard a lot, because Keith Jarrett was also very influential
mm-hmm.
to me.
Mm.
And I still hear now and then new recordings, old or more modern, that I simply haven't heard from Charlie Hayden. He
did a
he
lot.
Can do miracles with such a limited technique, if I may say so. As a bass player, his technique is very limited, but he reaches everything he needs to with that approach to the instrument that he has.
Mm.
No one else would probably be able to do the same.
Mm. Did you start learning the piano because of your brother, or was it the other way around?
I'm 5 years older than my brother, so I started playing the piano only because I guess I was told so.
Yeah.
I mean, and my father played piano. We had a piano at home, and I was obviously totally embraced by music, which I didn't know, of course, at young age. But piano, classical piano, and then inventing something we could call pre-level of jazz or complex rock or whatever. I formed different bands in my hometown. This is still early teenage years. But piano is a very natural instrument to me. And as you say, Dizzy Gillespie meant it was important, almost necessary. I avoid saying this to bass students because it's not so easy to learn piano at the age of 24, if you have never played it before. There's
mm-hmm.
so much work to do on the bass. And we both know fantastic musicians who doesn't have the academic or seemingly best way to reach their musical potential, but it works anyway. So I wouldn't say that piano is necessary, but I can say that it's been very beneficial for me to know the piano, to be able to try out whatever, and thinking a bass line and realizing how it needs to be adjusted since the chord is like this, blah, blah,
yeah.
blah. An overview of music that is very fruitful.
Mm. Is there a way you'd like to demonstrate or show a little bit how you transported that idea of voice leading, going through various harmonic ideas on the bass?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, like, there's no other instrument, or there's only an instrument which is harmonically very limited.
Mm-hmm.
What has helped you to get to get across a harmonic sequence without only playing the root?
Well, I can play something for me, and maybe you have questions, because I think I use voice leading, different means to create the obvious harmonic progression and still play the melody. Shall I try something?
Sure, yeah.
And see if you have comments and questions. Just checking. I play a piece, I say, like Miles Davis does on Relaxing with Miles. I'll play it and I'll tell you what it is later.
Mm-hmm. Bravo.
Oh, without being warmed up. Could you hear? Was the sound okay?
Mm? Oh, yeah, beautiful. Do you think of this song in D major or B minor?
B minor.
B minor, huh?
Mm.
Yeah. Beautiful. What is it?
Thank you. It is actually a folk song from the remotest part of the world that you can imagine, from North Korea.
Oh, wow.
I've been there twice, trying to spread the gospel of improvisation.
Uh-huh. They don't improvise?
No, they don't. But they were curious enough to invite me to the music academy in Pyongyang to lecture and present improvised music. I did play there at the academy, some solo bass, very little, and then had lots of meetings for actually two trips and many meetings, and got to know and meet many musicians. But we never really came to the collaboration I was dreaming of, having North Korean students in the academy in Göteborg, where I was a professor until recently.
Mm.
We got stuck on formalities, etc., etc. It's politically sensitive, but I wanted to bring improvisation, the free tone, the free sound, the free thought, the free word.
Mm.
I see it as a chain of development leading to positive things. And they were very curious, very respectful. We had nice hangs. talking around Bach and the way he improvised. So they were very knowledgeable, but have not no one there unless they are breaking the law, has listened to Louis Armstrong or Ella Fitzgerald or Keith Jarrett. It simply doesn't exist there. So I couldn't say I was playing jazz. I said improvised music. And when I improvised, I did it over folk music, Swedish or Argentinian or what. And this was a piece I learned over there. So it's a everyone in North Korea knows this. I don't know how, what to compare with in your country, but a very famous song. I hope I did it some justice. I was not well prepared, but that's it. And you could probably hear me trying to play several notes at a time, using harmonics or double stops to play three notes at the same time, etc., etc., in order to get the melody, rhythm, and harmony come through in whatever way I can and what I feel necessary.
Yeah, sometimes also the upbeat to the next melody note, or like a gesture towards the next melody note, can be something where you show the harmony, because you play a run towards the third, and the way you do it is maybe not just run a scale, but within a melodic lyrical way of doing it, you can
That's the
accent important notes that tell us what the chords are. I could understand perfectly what the harmonies
Okay.
are. Like,
Good,
maybe
good.
if you would have played 5 more minutes, I could have joined, if
Yes,
we would be in the
probably.
same,
I'm sure. Yeah.
because it's so easy, seemingly. But you make something that's hard to do, you make it sound easy.
Oh, thank
But
you.
I love
Thank you.
this way of when a bassist shows me a tune by playing it.
Okay, yeah.
You know?
Because, yeah. It is, as a pianist, you can play so many notes, so rich when it comes to harmony, that I may need a very trained ear to hear what is the melody, what is the second voice, and what is the bass, and which notes are not completely necessary but were played anyway. While a bass has the opposite challenge, can I get the full message? Can I show somehow the fundamental note, the melody note, and at least if it's minor or major, which you often cannot hear when a bass player plays it. We play maybe a fifth, and it's fascinating, but it doesn't give the full color of a piece. And then when we come to seven or major seven, it's even more. So yeah, but that makes it interesting and challenging to play the bass, to see how far you can come. Having said all this, I don't consider the bass as a solo instrument. It's in interplay where I find myself on the deepest level. This is practicing stuff. If I have to play alone, I can do this, but I
Well,
enjoy most.
you've made a couple of solo albums as well.
I've made two solo albums, and but these have been practicing goals for me to develop my knowledge of the instrument. Of course, I put lots of efforts and ambitions in it, but I would like to state, since people will look at this, that the important thing and the most rewarding thing in our fields of music, I think, is interplay. The joy, the gift, and the challenge to start a conversation with a person you either know very well or hardly at all, and try to find each other without trying to convince the other one how this piece has to be played, to be curious, open, and still have the skills enough to join the trip, so to speak.
Yeah. I really like those two beautiful solo albums. Also
Thank you.
the newer one with the little miniatures for woodwinds. Very cool.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And you do you know the story behind that? Probably you don't. I recorded the album without those horn
I
miniatures.
think you wrote it in the liner notes,
I did. Okay,
saying
yeah.
that that Manfred
Oh, I did.
suggested to mix up a little bit.
And I didn't like the idea at first. I took it in the wrong way. But
Yeah, because that's so fragile. You just recorded a solo album, and it's only you, and somebody says
There's
something is
something
missing,
missing.
which basically says you're not enough.
No. Well, I don't think that's what he meant.
No.
I felt like that
Yeah.
for a day or two or whatever. But since we all share this big amount of respect for Manfred Eicher and
Yeah.
his ECM records, and since he suggested it, he didn't force it, but he suggested it and told me, think of it. And I did, and I couldn't really judge if this was a good idea or bad, so I had to trust him, and then went on to writing those small pieces, which became quite beautiful, I think myself, or it works in this context, and it makes it a different album. So I'm happy afterwards for that process.
Yeah.
I also had a piece where I sang, which Manfred nicely said, "I don't think we shall use this." So there were two things I had to
Yeah.
accept.
I see. What did you sing?
I can hardly remember now. Just as a third voice or whatever, something
Oh,
that I
right.
felt
Okay.
was needed,
Yeah.
probably more. And maybe this was a very, once again, a good decision by an experienced producer. But you have to kill your own darlings
Oh, yeah.
sometimes.
Always. Also with composition, all the time. I just transcribed this right before we started talking.
Allegretto rubato. Yes. I'm so sorry I couldn't
No,
send
it's
it.
perfect that you didn't send
Wow.
it.
What an ear you must have.
I don't know if I made everything correctly. I was just wondering, did you kill some darlings for this, or was it only those four bars?
I can't remember. Can you play it for me? To see if I... Yeah, but the next part.
The next part, maybe I missed the next part.
I'm not sure actually if it's 4 or 8 bars long. It sounds a little short in my head, but this piece I haven't played for so long. I
I
even
don't know
need you
if you
to play
hear
the first
this.
phrase.
I don't know if you hear this.
Let's try.
Give
Since you
me a
want to.
thumbs up or thumbs down if
Yeah,
you,
yeah.
right? Okay, I'll try.
Beautiful.
And this is played twice, right? And
Yeah,
then it's
what a
free
great ear
improv.
you have. Then it's free. I think this is the composition, yes.
This is the
I
song,
may
right?
have had a further development somewhere on music paper, but we decided to play it like this. It's an early Bobo Stinson album, is it?
I think it's
Or
on
where?
Goodbye.
Okay.
And I also found a bootleg of you guys playing it with Paul Motion in Sweden somewhere.
Wow, okay. Yeah, we had it in the repertoire for a while, and
A very, very beautiful
is
song.
it three-part writing, is it?
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly.
Which I've done very much of this three-part writing, and sometimes into four-part writing, with trying to develop the traditional four-part writing that you learn in classical harmony studies somehow.
It reminded me a bit of Federico Mompou's music.
Yeah.
You guys played also one of his pieces.
We do, but I think at that time I'm not sure that I knew so much about Mompou that I do now. So this is more, I don't know where inspiration to such a piece, but I have over the years written quite many of sounding like this, trying to a kind of harsh melodicism, expanding harmony, implying some kind of polytonality maybe, but only with three voices.
Yeah, I really love, that's what reminds me of Mompou, because he's able to also do that with so sometimes only two, sometimes three voices, four voices, but coming up with so rich sounding harmonies because of the choices of intervals that he has,
Yes,
right?
yes, yes.
Because certain intervals they ring if you put together. If you put them together, they ring in a different way.
True.
That brings out more harmonics, more overtones. It's very, very interesting. So this is
I
really
agree.
something that feels very, very close and yeah, beautiful to me. And you know,
And I
I've set up the lights and the microphone. It was 9 o'clock, and I was
Yeah.
like, okay, we're talking in 1 hour. Usually I write down notes,
Okay.
but
You didn't.
I didn't feel
That's
like it, so I've
fine.
said, okay, I need to, I want to learn this song. So it
Fantastic,
was beautiful.
fantastic. And I'm so impressed by your skills in what do we, transcribing. And
Thank you.
I'm so grateful that you have, before we meet here, asked me, can you send this and this? And I feel really old school, but it's the way I am. Or very much of the music I compose, I have composed, is on paper and with paper and pen.
Yeah.
This is for young people to hear that this is what we
Yeah.
did way back. And I have cupboards, lots, piles of
Yeah.
music. And when you ask me for, do you have song 80? Yeah, shit, where is this
Yeah.
repertoire? And I have maybe 150 different, I have it organized in special containers, and I simply couldn't find the original, and I became a little worried. Have I lost it? I think it's there somewhere, and I just have to tell myself I have to spend some time on scanning the repertoire.
Scanning is good because I think the scanning part, because that's how I do it. I also write with, I can't write with the computer.
Right, me neither.
I just do it by hand. And the more I've been doing it always, so it gets better and better.
Yeah,
And I learn more about it when I read how somebody else writes down their
I
music, right?
agree.
But then I scan it and then I have it on the computer for all
Very
time,
good,
you know?
very good. And this last step I need to learn. But you are very right that handwriting makes you come closer to the process. I
Yes.
think composing, I write nowadays my music or for orchestra or whatever on the computer, finally. But I have done it. The original score is
But
on
not the
paper.
symphony, though.
Now, well, the symphony was also done on paper first,
First.
but then I used the computer as a typewriter, basically,
Yeah.
just to make it look good.
Yeah.
But in the process of handwriting, which is then sometimes slower, you get time for a second opinion about the choice you're about to make, and you may avoid the dividing music in those 4, 8, 16, blah. That is easily, too easily, a result of copying
Oh, yeah.
in the composing process, and you can maybe even hear it sometimes in young musicians' compositions, that the speed and the technical possibilities of computer composing tricks you to be too fast.
Yeah.
And repetitions, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So,
what do you think about repetitions?
Well, I have a simple rule for myself. Repetition is nice, but it shouldn't be a copy of what you just heard. So my repetitions are always different, meaning it can be dynamically different, it can be expressively different, it can be the same melody, the same bass part, but there comes a third voice.
Yes. Yeah.
So
I feel that
if we would go through my scores and many other great good musicians' scores, we would find that behind a seemingly a repetition, there is a new element or a new way of approaching the repetition.
Right. With this song, I feel like you only wrote down those four bars, but the next time you play it, I immediately hear you going into second gear in terms of bass accompaniment, or it becomes more solistic on the recording. So,
wow, yeah, thank you. Yeah, those were great. I can't remember for how long Paul Motion played with Bobo Stins on Tree, but they were good years for sure.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit more about the experience of playing with him, how it felt?
Well, you can imagine meeting such a hero for the first time. I was probably kind of worried or tense or how will this work? He is so good. But it was so easy to play with him, and I'm quite sure that every musician would say this. The greatest drummers I have, or the drummers that have inspired me the most, are the ones that doesn't force me to play in a certain way, but give space for the pianist to play what he or she wants, bass player what he or she wants. So it's open, and this is Paul Motion is one of those. Jon Christensen was another one, and Jon Feld, who plays with Bobo now since several years, is the same. You can play whatever on bass, and they make you sound good. And I have the same dream vision that I shall make you sound good when we play together. And that's the essence of interplay somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It felt amazing to play with you, by the way. It's a long time ago.
Likewise.
Right now.
It's a long time ago. Was it Italy? Or
it was in Italy, and John Taylor had just passed, and we did a tribute. We did it. I actually listened to the recording of it also like last week.
Okay.
So, and it was nice to revisit, but also I felt bad because I felt like I was overplaying the whole time. And I was still in a phase where a big development for myself, maybe other people don't hear it so much, but a big step in towards not playing as much, not overplaying as much, which is still the little devil behind me. It came after we met. So I went through several months, maybe a year even, of really, really fighting the need to play.
This is a challenge for all of us if we devote our life to music and spend so much time on learning our instrument better and deeper and all directions. What shall we do with all this knowledge?
Exactly, yeah.
And that takes time, for sure. And I understand what you say, because I can still feel I play too much. Sometimes it's motivated. Sometimes it gives energy and sparkle. It can inspire other people, etc. But we know this less is more phrase. It is not always true, but it is not fake news either.
Exactly.
There is something to it, finding the essence. And that's why I talk about Charlie Hayden, who finds the essence, while so many other bass players would solve it in a different way. But he can really find the essence. And I'm sure we can think of other musicians whose, should we say, unacademic, homemade or limited technique makes them expand other dimensions than a bunch of notes, the sound, the expressivity, how they interplay. So there is many ways of developing your musicality once you have nailed the technical challenges. And that process, that trip, that's lifelong, isn't it?
It is.
And we may start composing different, and we may start playing different. That's a process.
Mm-hmm. With Paul Motion, did you get to rehearse, or did it, because he's known for not wanting to rehearse?
With Paul, I think Bobo and I, we had a repertoire, and we always slowly but constantly give ourselves new material, new challenges, and Paul was only hanging in there. I think, I didn't think of it, but you're right. I wonder if we ever did something that we can call rehearsal. I think we started on bringing him over for a Scandinavian tour, and we just met, 3 hours before the concert, trying out the instruments. And he came without his own drums. That's normal nowadays, but maybe also without his own cymbals. I can't remember. At least he did that in the very end. He didn't bring anything. He had a very quick ear, and he probably has worked like that all his life. And if you listen, I guess you can sense that he is actually listening quite actively the two first concerts, and then he knows the repertoire as well as you or I. This is his way of, I think, challenging himself. Like I praised Gary Peacock, just going out there in the unknown. So even if you play quite traditional forms, he made himself go out there in the unknown. And that's when he could find his focus and his top level of interplay. While other musicians can find the same springboard for openness by being well prepared.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. The process isn't the same for everybody.
No. And we could make theories on not being prepared playing the piano is one thing, not being prepared playing the drums in a setting where the melody and harmonies is given by piano and bass. It gives also a decent chance for him to do something fascinating without knowing what is happening, because the important framework is done by the other instruments.
Exactly. Yeah, it so suits his way of playing, his way of comping. Because if he would be, let's say, Steve Gadd playing that, or although maybe Steve Gadd is also somebody who learns through the ear, but he's somebody who marks the phrases a little bit more, comes from a different way of playing. But yeah, it really suits Paul's way of playing, that kind of approach of not preparing. Although when I hear him on your piece, like where it changes from 5 to 6 Rovan.
Wow,
you sometimes I hear him, you know, taking care of it, and sometimes not, you know, and that creates a beautiful tension.
I didn't think of that, but you're right. He's a totally intuitive player, and that momentaneous intuition in improvised music is so important, and that's what we all wish to have. And certain musicians just have it, and it's a mix of understanding, experience, and daring mentally to take a chance, to take a risk. And also, I think, trusting. I think Paul Motion have been able to trust his fellow musicians. I mean, look at his recording. He's played with the greatest guys, and they know what they are doing. So he can trust that he doesn't have to help the band.
He also knows what he's... or they know what they're asking him for, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not replacing Steve Gadd.
Yeah, exactly. And we love Steve Gadd. That's
said it because it was your an example out of the blue. But
I was also thinking about
different approaches.
Chick Corea played with Paul Motion, but when he played with him, he didn't play the electric band repertoire. He played like it was a tribute to Bill Evans. How was it to be with that sound that you know from Trio 64 and all these albums, like to finally be like, oh wow, this is my bass note and his cymbal, it goes together.
that's a good question. And I mean, I played with Elvin Jones, Paul Motion, Jack DeJohnette, Jon Christensen for many years. I mean, some absolute heroes and important figures in jazz. I could have been scared to death. But the only thing that saves me when I play with people who I may have admired for many years is the fact that I try to involve with music. Once the first note is played, I don't think of who's on the behind the drum set. I'm there trying to create the overall organic result of the music we do together, trying to play what I sense is needed. And so I don't think, who are my fellow musicians? Are they well known?
Oh yeah.
Or am I the most experienced guy? I don't think like that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I should be thankful because there has been moment in my musical life where there could have been reasons. I play with famous people, no preparation. There were many possibilities to be worried, but no.
It doesn't help.
Doesn't help, and it's not about who you play with, it's about the music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have admired Kenny Wheeler and John Taylor so much, but I was not worried when I played with them. And once again, a great musician, John Taylor, for example, he gives trust to his musicians, and you feel this. You don't have to go through a long semi-psychology talk to be able to play with others. It's about sensing your own confidence and giving confidence, trusting each other and trusting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key.
Let me know if you also know this this feeling. You play with the band for a long time, and that gives you confidence and trust. I have had this trio with my friends for almost 20 years, and we've been playing together, and I've noticed that I take the trust that I have with them, somehow I take it into other experiences.
Yeah.
Because it's the trust in them, but also the trust in myself. I take it into other experiences of playing with others. Mm. Although I don't know them, I kind of know the possibility that is there for trust.
Very good expression. And I think this... Yeah, you have experienced this giving and taking trust for so long that you bring it as a natural way of sharing music. That's excellent. But I even think that through 20 years of playing, also with maybe not with a regular band, but with many different bands, can give you more or less the same.
Mm.
Trying, sensing that, yeah, it works more and more often.
Yeah.
So I think what we are talking about in general is the importance of experience and the importance of actually learning, like you have done, from the experience. Because if you are too worried, a worried kind of musician, you will not trust what you have actually experienced and what you have learned from that experience. I think I can have seen that over the years with students who have so much trouble trusting that they are really on their way. They are achieving something stronger and more convincing than the previous year, but they cannot embrace that feeling. So, so there is quite many being an artist, being an improvising musician, involved playing with other musicians, involves also so many dimensions beyond the chord progressions the time signature.
It does.
That you have to handle, have to learn from, and maybe help each other with now and then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I only found one track from the recording with Elvin that you did.
Okay.
It was a very involved 12-8 thing.
Okay. I looked some years ago for it on Spotify and those streaming services, and I couldn't find it. And I Googled a little, and I saw the label doesn't exist anymore, so it was never put out there. But then guitar player Arne Jansen from the Hannover School, he told me about this album, and I said, no, I don't. I lost that album many years ago, and it's not possible to find. And then just half a year ago, he found it in some shop, so he sent it to me.
Oh, beautiful.
So now I have the LP again.
Ah, great.
So probably it doesn't exist on CD.
Yeah, yeah. I found somebody filming playing the LP on YouTube.
Wow.
So it's just one track, but the band sounds incredible.
But it was with the great Albert Mangelsdorf
who
put this session together. And we toured a little with on trio with Elvin. For the recording, there is also Wolfgang Dauner playing the piano.
Yeah.
And that was a great experience to play with Elvin. And talking about respect and worries, of course, I wondered, how shall this be myself, knowing that I'm pretty much on top of the beat, as we say, eager to go forward, and Elvin being the role model for laid back time feeling.
Yeah.
Would we separate and have different downbeats in 5 seconds, or what would happen? No, so easy to play with, and he was very nice and friendly and warm. So this is a good memory, how I could buy beer to him in the recording studio, and when we played, and he made sandwiches for me and I poured beer. That's a nice thing to remember. And he also, after these collaborations with Albert, he contacted me and wanted me to come to Japan to start a jazz school with him.
Wow.
And I was, of course, very happy. You know, his wife Keiko was Japanese, so this was probably an idea from her. And he knew I was teaching, so And I presented the idea at home, but there was no interest to move to Japan, or so I had to say no to that. I couldn't, you know, children, all this.
Yeah. Did he ever give you any advice?
No, not really. Not musically, but Billy Hart has been quite influential to me, giving me some advice. Yeah, this is probably the best advice I got from Billy Hart. And this is, we were touring over Europe with Kenny Wheeler. And I was young, so this is many years ago.
Kenny Wheeler, you, Billy Hart, and who else?
Bobo Stenson, I think.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, we played gig after gig. And this was the first time I played with Billy. So I could sense that he liked me. He was very, yeah, man, that kind of. And then he took me aside after the tour. Anders, come here. And then he started praising me, how good I played. And I became 2 centimeters longer of pride. And then he said, but Anders, stop quoting. And quoting means, for everyone who sees this, borrowing phrases from other famous jazz recordings, solos or melodies or whatever. Which is a part of the jazz tradition, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I thought this was hip. Not only can I play decent bass, but I can also quote American phrases from John Coltrane or Miles Davis or whatever. Because I had heard that many, especially older jazz musicians, used to do this.
Yeah.
And you smile every time you recognize Stella by Starlight, but you're playing But Not For Me, yeah, or something. But he said, Anders, you are so personal, you are so original, but this quoting doesn't belong to your aesthetics or tradition. And since that day, I have never quoted. And that was a really good advice.
Mm.
Because it is not natural for me. I could do it, and I thought, it should be done if you only can. But if you look upon it from outside, you shall not play things only because you can. You shall play them because they are motivated. And he was totally right. A young Scandinavian bass player has his tradition of his own. Why should I copy something done by Ben Webster or Lester Young or whoever?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever musicians that added this to jazz music. So I actually felt that advice gave me more confidence and made me realize that you have to choose carefully what you play when you improvise.
Mm.
And don't imitate historical periods or musicians from other parts of the world. Respect them, but do your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually what, even though Billy didn't use these words, but he's a very wise musician.
Oh, yeah. He is. It's so encouraging.
So that was very rewarding for me.
Yeah. Beautiful. I just had to think of Sonny Rollins. He kind of, how do you say, he didn't advertise it, but he said, like, to him, quoting, when you play one standard, quoting the other standard is a big challenge and a sign that you really know a lot about music. Because to be able to imagine something else on top of something else is, in a way, is also improvisation. But I totally see Billy's point in terms of actually giving you the freedom to be, to embrace your musical upbringing and your experience.
Yeah, so I'm very grateful to Billy for this. It meant a difference to me, and I think showing that you know so much about music, I really don't want that to be the purpose for me performing. I mean, you know so much about music, but why should this be presented to the audience? Is that actually what we want to share with our audience or our fellow musicians? When we think of it, no, it's probably something else. It's it's a communication, opening each other's hearts or whatever philosophical thoughts we may have. But it's not about showing off my knowledge of music, at least not for me. So I deeply respect Sonny Rollins' point of view, but that is not my purpose of
Well, if you look at Sonny Rollins' statement from Billy's perspective, I think he wouldn't say to Sonny Rollins, don't do it.
Of course not.
Because he's doing what Billy Hart told you to do, basically, or not to do. You know, he's doing the reverse because he's coming, that's his background.
Absolutely.
He's doing
that's
it.
That's right. That's true. So, and yeah, that's a perfect interpretation of what Billy's message was.
Of course, I wanted to know more about John Taylor. Whenever I get to be with somebody who spent time with him, because I spent time with him, we can't anymore.
You were his student.
Was his student.
Yeah.
Studied with him from 2005 until 2008 or 7. And after that, we met each other on concerts. I remember one concert where I saw you with him at Jazz Baltica with Marilyn Mazur.
Oh, yeah.
Her quartet. That was beautiful. And we hung afterwards. John and me hung afterwards. So I saw John at festivals and places where he played opposite each other.
John was a fantastic musician. And yeah, he was a really good friend. We really came along. We became close. We had some great moments discussing life and music, traveling all over the world, basically, together in different constellations. And for a time, John had a trio. When he started his trio after many years again, it was with me and Joey Baron.
That's what I asked you about when we played. You know, when we played, I think that's the first thing I asked you about, because that's one of my favorite trios, the one which was documented with Mark Johnson. But I heard that you played in this trio as well, and I so want to hear this.
me too. I don't know of any recordings. We worked through Andrea Marini, the Italian agent who worked with John and with Kenny Wheeler, and partly with me as well. So we did some tours, but probably there are recordings, radio recordings or whatever, but I don't know. I have none of them. But when it came to record for ECM, Manfred had the thought that this would compete with Bobo Stenson trio. So he wanted different setup, as different as possible. So I guess it ended up with Palle Danielsson and Martin Franz. Is that right?
No, on the recording it's Mark Johnson and Joey Baron. And afterwards, when John stopped being with ECM, it ended up being Martin Franz and Palle Danielsson.
But in that period in between, isn't that where me and Joey Baron plays? After the Mark Johnson record, but before Palle and Martin Franz.
I think so, yeah.
That's where I play with John. And we were planning, we were meant to record for ECM. But between Manfred and John, there were some talks about making sure this is different, blah, blah, blah. And it ended up, even though we had just performed, Joey, me and John, that the album was recorded with two other musicians. And John wasn't, he felt bad.
Mm.
He said that, but of course no hard feelings. But then once the album came out, he started playing with that band.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember we had a wonderful concert with Joey and John, one of the concerts I remember best in my life, in a, what was the name, something, the old Philharmonic Hall in Verona, where Data Philharmonica, something, it was the name. And the last time improvisations had been done in this very highly serious classical music hall, old hall, was the last time improvisation had been allowed was when Mozart was improvising in there.
And all that's right, pretty okay.
hip.
That's very
and hip. There was a bat up in the high roof, and they said, oh, it's the same bat as in Mozart.
How old are bats?
I have no idea. This was probably a myth. But it was obviously an achievement from our agent to convince the staff there to allow us in yeah. there. And they were sitting in the front row, a bunch of classical musicians who went from angry to totally smiling during a concert.
Yeah.
And John's piano playing was just fantastic. When I must say this to everyone who wants to hear John Taylor and where to start. There is a version of Everything I Love with Peter Erskine Trio, Palle Danielsson on bass. And that interpretation that John does of Everything I Love, that's top, 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 top. And you can hear his rhythmic excellence and the touch. Boom! You need only one tone to hear. It's like a bell when he plays the piano. I have no idea. And I asked him very early in our collaboration, have you studied a lot of classical music? Because his touch is like, I don't know, Richter or whatever. But obviously he didn't at all. He meant he was more or less, he learned himself.
More or less self-taught, yeah.
With that
he studied
sound.
Classical music on his own afterwards, you know. He would bring sheet music to the lessons also and tell me to learn or to look at Hindemith and stuff like that, you know. Oscar Peterson was his first hero.
Yeah,
and then
I must tell you this story. I recently, once again, in a back room or after the concerts, was talking to another hero, Dave Holland. And I told Dave, oh, wow, that, he was influential to me way back. Oh, I know how it is. You know. And then he told me and John Taylor, we moved to London and we lived in the same flat. I wanted to be Ray Brown. He wanted to be Oscar Peterson, he said.
Yeah.
And we played, he said, in a bar somewhere. And one day there was a young girl came up and sang. She sang quite good. But after the melody, she continued improvising. That was Norma.
Yeah.
Norma Winston. And that's how they met and became close friends. Fantastic story.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Wow. Did you just see Dave with John Scofield in duo?
No, I saw him with Ralph Towner in Elbphilharmonie. We shared concert this autumn.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, beautiful.
That's when he told me this story.
Yeah.
How they met Norma.
Yeah. It was so beautiful that you shared the chart of Rowan. Or is it Rowan or how
Rowan.
Do you call it?
Rowan,
okay.
Yeah.
Rowan, and then I immediately recognized John's handwriting on the one chart that you sent me.
He transcribed it to A major.
Exactly.
I wrote it to C major, but then we played it in A because...
Diana?
Probably not Diana, but Maria Pia De Vito.
Oh, right. Okay,
sang
yeah.
it. Maybe also Diana, actually. But
it's nice in A, too.
Maria Pia has recorded it. Yeah, maybe it's better in A, actually.
I think it lies very nicely on the piano in A.
I agree.
Yeah.
But that was a suitable vocal key, like a wish from, I think, Maria Pia, who wrote lyrics to it. So she has recorded it with another name.
What I like about the song, one of the things that I like about the song is, and that's something that I had to allow myself, and I still remember that feeling when I first did it, when, you know, when you first start composing and you find the sheet of paper, you do like this, okay, four bars. Mm. You kind of set the, without writing down notes, you kind of...
Yeah.
Set the form already.
Yes, exactly.
And you write 4-4 even, maybe.
Yeah.
And then it's 4-4 forever,
absolutely.
You know? Mm-hmm. And in your piece, I like, and it's, of course, in your music as in general, like that, if a melody wants to be longer than the, you know,
exactly,
than the meter you're in, then it has to be longer because your melody doesn't fit into the meter. You have to change according to the melody or to the flow, you know?
Yeah. And according to breath, the need of breath, the need of pause.
Yes.
So when composing a melody, in general nowadays, I try to sing it along. And if there are lyrics, it's easy, because then you definitely need to adapt to whatever rhythm and phrasing that a modern poem, for example, may have, which is not always regular. But in general... I try to sing a phrase, and when you come to a certain point in a long phrase, you realize, I need to breathe. And then the phrase is too long. I have to rewrite it. It is not, of course, the whole truth, but if a phrase is so long or is followed so quickly with a new phrase, it's overkill sometimes.
Yeah.
You need to breathe also as a listener.
Yeah. I love these harmonies also. Like,
thank you.
It's so inviting.
Mm, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about the... Like, I have very very basic question about writing a symphony.
Mm, yeah.
Which sounds very banal. But there are symphonies. And when is the point where you decide on... I actually need three horns instead of two.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
I know. Yeah, in this special... When I have written for those big orchestras, I have been given the setup. So let's say this symphony that you have heard was a commission from the symphony orchestra in Wrocław, Poland, who commissioned this work to me. And the first thing I do is, okay, what's your setting? How many flutes do you have? Blah, blah, blah. And then you are given on a paper, this is our setup. And it's difficult to find two chamber orchestras or two symphony orchestras that have exactly the similar setup. There is something close to a standard, but some orchestra have three trumpets, some have only two, etc., etc. And also some orchestras have pretty much of horn players, but surprisingly few strings. And it can also be the opposite. And you have to make some mistakes, including my own, to realize that you have to write in a specific way if there is a limited amount of strings in every orchestra. And you can write proudly in yet another way if there are lots of strings, if there are 10 strings in each section, because that sounds so big. And it gives you sound-wise different opinions. And I think I have sometimes written with the imagination that six violins sounds more than they actually do. So I have learned this, that you have really to...
In other words, the chord or the harmony sounded too small.
Yeah, somehow.
And you actually imagined them to sound bigger.
So what I think I'm saying is writing for a small symphony orchestra, sometimes called sinfonietta, writing for a chamber orchestra and writing for a full symphony orchestra, that could seemingly be the same thing. It's just different amount of players on each instrument. But it's actually sound-wise a bit more different than I could expect. So I can hear here and there that I have been... or let me say, when we talk about this symphony that you have heard, I wish there would have been more musicians in the string section. Mm-hmm. It would sound better. But so that was a kind of learning process for me. And also that what you have on that recording is actually the general rehearsal. There are some mistakes that we corrected for the concert. But the concert recording, the Polish radio forgot to put on the flute and oboe mics.
Oh, okay.
So we played better, but the horns were gone. So what is there is actually the last rehearsal, you know, the general rehearsal. And
interesting.
That's what's on the album. So between you and me, there is a couple of mistakes, a couple of bad intonations, a couple of tempos that could have been... that were changed till the evening. But this is, you know, the general rehearsal is the last chance to correct something. But this is the only recording where everyone was heard. And then the flutes and oboes.
Well, you know, I never knew this detail, and I love the album. So.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy. This is reality behind... There's a reality behind everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but... writing for a symphony orchestra is—it takes time for me, but it's really rewarding. It's so exciting, and
did it start with all the movements? Did they start out being, let's say, a simple song before, and then you fleshed them out?
No, I think it could be that there were one or two movements that existed as a kind of piano trio sketch or as a piano piece first. But in general, most of it was played with me imagining, not another sound and then bringing it to the orchestra, but imagining the orchestra from the start. Mm. Even though my experience was limited at that time, and I always try to write for a certain instrument. So a melody is not only a melody, it is an English horn melody, and that's why I write it like this. It's a cello feature, and then I write it like this. And then, of course, you can reach some limits or borders where you actually force the flute to play something that would maybe sound better on a register-wise, on a clarinet. But I really want the flute in low register, which is a challenge in orchestra because they are not heard. Oh, then I have to write the harp. Has to accompany. I think there is one piece there where I remember the flute goes all the way down to the low C, which is almost the lowest note. But I know nothing more beautiful than the flute in low register, played by a flute player, not a jazz tenor saxophonist who has a flute. You know.
Yeah.
So then I write it, but then I...
who has a flute? It's a nice way to put it.
I sometimes say that when I present a group and I own a bass, I sometimes say. So sometimes you have to, even though we learn in schools that flute in low register is a challenge. You should avoid blah blah blah. Yeah, I think it says in all books, don't write under A, which is six notes higher than six steps higher than its low note, because you won't hear it. But well, you hear it there. But I have pianissimo harp accompanying it, and the rest of the orchestra basically silent until blah blah. So this is not what we call. No, I lost the word. When you write considering the special instrument,
oh, it a will feature come. Or
no, what? Oh, I forgot the word. There is a special word for writing so that it fits a certain instrument. But sometimes you have to push the limits too, because you long for the sound. And I have maybe two things that I think of when I write for orchestra. It's complex harmony. You can write it for violins. It always sounds good. You can make as complex intervals as possible. There is always a sweetness to the violins. But if you write for brass, complex harmonic writing will have a tendency to be slightly out of tune. So if you want major and minor chords, put them in the brass. It still sounds fantastic. I mean, because they are so rich in overtones.
Yeah.
So I often do simple writing, horns, complex harmonically, strings, some small.
That's good advice.
Yeah.
What I also like about the symphony is usually I've heard many symphonies. But when I go back to a symphony, I always just go back to the slow movement. although you're... because I'm not always in the mood for the whole 60-minute experience, extravaganza. I don't know. But usually I feel the most with the slow movements. It's often with classical music like that. Also with jazz sometimes. And although there is a big finale in your symphony and the choir comes in, you know, I still feel like your symphony is a lot of slow movements, or they have the positive aspect of the lyrical, melody-driven, emotional content that the slow movement have. That's in a way, I get that's the same experience from your whole symphony.
Yeah, thank you. And you know, getting a commission of a symphony, you always have to be in consideration, symphony, does it mean a piece of music that is 45 minutes long, but I decide how? Or do I have to stick to the academic definition of a symphony with four movements, blah, 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 or whatever. There is rules or ideas about what is a symphony and what is not a symphony. This I remember someone asked me, but is this a symphony? Because I think it's eight movements, or what is it? Or eight pieces, or whatever you and I would call it. But there is always lots of freedom invited in a conception, and there is also lots of rules. So I decided not to write the most traditional piece. And if it's a symphonic suite, or if it's a correct symphony, is not very interesting to me. It's it was a commission. Please write music with this length, and that I did. And I called the whole concert Symphony of Birds.
Why is that? I mean, some of the titles have references, or maybe all of them have.
All of them have titles. I think.
I don't know all the words.
The inspiration, actually, I often find inspiration in nature. And this was written in a period where I, after stressing very much in my life as a touring musician and a teacher as well, I felt I need something that could be called a hobby. So just that period, I tried to become an ornithologist, only to change my mind. So it was a upcoming interest for birds that I have not really, really carefully developed, but it wasn't a try to have another passion besides music. And I found somewhere in a book the interesting thing that in Sweden we have one word saying for a bunch of birds, en flock med fåglar. We have one word, flock. That means a gathering of birds. Right. 20 or 200 doesn't matter, the same word. But in British, there is heron, which is a kind of bird. When you say many herons, you say a siege of herons. But when there are many owls, you don't say a siege of owls, you say parliament of owls. So there is, for each specific bird, there is a unique word expressing many of those. So all the titles is Ascension of Larks, I think, is one of the name. And that's make you think of John Coltrane's Ascension, maybe. But also, that's a gathering of larks. So it's not the same word as if it's a gathering of another species. And that's kind of beautiful. Mm-hmm. So that's where the titles came from. And of course, flying, bird, beauty.
Mm. Ascension of Larks is also beautiful to compare the other version with the that's on the choir album.
Yes, yes.
And then also this song is a beautiful example where you play it unaccompanied, how you deal with what we talked before about voice leading and creating harmony. Mm-hmm. In a solo bass setting.
Yeah.
Those are beautiful changes.
Yeah. And that whole choir album that you are now talking about came after me meeting this choir for this symphony. They were hired in for the last movement because I was told it was a possibility. And then we found each other, the choir and me, the choir leader and me. And they asked, shouldn't we do a collaboration? Blah, blah, blah. And up came this Arma album, which was recorded a year or two later, which was also a very nice experience to write for choir and.
Oh yes.
And try to comp them.
Mm-hmm. And they comp for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Hemingway intonations.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about the process of writing this one?
Yeah, I think that's. When it comes to certain sentences, certain stanzas, as I think you can say in English, there is hardly anything more heartbreaking than Hemingway, who as I have been told or have read, he made some kind of bet where he said he could write a novel, a great novel, with only 6 words.
Yeah,
and that was some kind of bet in a bar kind of thing, as far as I've understood it. But what he wrote was, for sale, baby shoes, never worn.
Mm.
And that's a fantastic sentence, isn't it? It's heartbreaking. And you, if you want, you see a whole film or you see a whole novel, you see a whole life in front of for your inner eyes. Fantastic, strong sentence. And that simply just inspired me to write what I wrote. And if I am right, I think the first sketch, or should we say, the first version of this was a commission in Italy, sung by Diana Torto, and with string trio. So the first version of this was for cello, viola, violin, and Diana Torto, who played it on a festival.
Beautiful.
Then the composition was there, and I wrote it for choir.
Did John ever play it with you?
I think so. I think so. Maybe once or twice or three times. That's a good question. I'm not sure.
I would love to hear his sound with those voicings, you know.
Boom. Bell.
I mean, Bobo sounds great with the song as well. He sounds incredible playing it.
Yeah, but I agree. John's touch makes all the strings in the piano work together to create so many overtones. I don't know what he, if it's his work with pedal or if the touch, it's as if he inspires the piano to produce more well-sounding overtones than any other pianist I know.
Yeah, very, very special. In the liner notes to the AMA recording, there's on the song M, I think, you said it was inspired by your study of mean tone.
Yes.
What is it?
No, mean
I don't know
tone
what it is.
is, it's called Medelton in my language. It's a way of tuning organs and keyboard instruments before Das Wohltemperierte Klavier. You know, Das Wohltemperierte Klavier is an homage to the new way of tuning where you finally could play chromatic. That's Bach's. He was happy for that, we can think. Before that, you were tuning with, I never learned the English word, but the thirds were correct. You know, on a modern piano, they are wrong. And in modern tuning, they are always wrong. We call it, I don't know the English words, but you know what I'm talking about. Before that, the thirds were as they are in nature, not mathematically corrected. That means that a major chord way back before Bach sounded fantastic in certain keys, in six keys. So the six well-sounding keys were B flat, F, C. You go in fifths. B flat, F, C, G, D, and A. When you then continue, the way that the piano is tuned, producing those natural big thirds, certain keys sound shit. Church organs before Bach had two keys for G sharp and A flat. There were different keys. There was a G sharp key built into the A flat key because you can imagine the third in E major were totally different than the third in F minor, for example. You couldn't use the same. But so it meant that you could write only in specific ways using specific keys and intervals. And this I studied a little. So that piece M was written for another album called Songs in Mean Tone that I did with a church organ player and a folk flute player.
Oh,
Songs in Mean
I don't know
Tone.
this one.
Look it up,
Okay.
it's very good. We also did a second album called Tantum. So it's a church organ improviser, folk flute player, and me. And there we play on an old flute on a church organ tuned in 415. A was 415 at that time. And flutes were also different. So when we play in D minor, organ played in D minor, I played in E flat minor, and the flute player, I think, played in E. Because, you know, A was so different in different traditions, even in different cities way, way back. So, and this church organ was tuned in mean tone. So then I tried to explore how far can I go and it still sounds good on this organ. Songs in Mean Tone is the album, and it's we did lots of research there actually. Yeah, so yeah, that's interesting to check out how there were totally different possibilities and limitations way back before the modern keyboard tuning came during Bach. And I have had periods when I've looked at medieval music because it's interesting.
It says in the liner notes that there are harmonies that derive from that tuning. Mm-hmm. Are these the harmonies that you just found because they sounded good in that tuning, or because also the connections of these harmonies sounded quite special?
Yeah, and if you remember what I said, B flat, F, C, G, D, and A. Those six triads are what I use in the whole A section, combined with a free choice of bass notes. So, so that's what I mean when derived from. It's the six possible, still well-sounding major keys, chords you could use on an organ tuned in mean tone. And then the short B section is natural thirds moved around. So yeah, it's theoretically inspired, expanding whatever you can do with strict limitations from what the mean tone tuning gives you. And that's, I guess you agree with me, is always fascinating as a composer when you give yourself limitations. Mm. If you read what great composers through history have said about composing, they said, the more limitations I get, the more free I get, I become.
Yeah.
Like if we let's write a piece in 17/8, shit, we are directly out there, and we start being creative instead of using what we normally do. So that's that's challenges make you sometimes use more of your creativity than you do if like you say 4/4 and we do this.
What is something that you're working on right now at the bass?
Well, this is now the end of. I took pretty much off in the summer here, so I'm mainly working on keeping my playing skills up. I'm not working on something specific. I think I am in the beginning of forming maybe a new ensemble or at least a new project. I talked to Manfred Eicher recently and he inspired me to do something, but I don't know what it will be yet. I just feel the inner need coming and I have no idea what it will be, but I hope to do some, should we call it, inner research during the autumn and find out. And then write music for this setting, whatever it will be.
I'm interested. How do you usually find out what it is?
Well, sometimes we get help from outside. You get a request. You get a commission. Can you write something for a church organ? Shit, yeah, I would never have thought of that. And then or a commission from a symphony orchestra or a big band or whatever, but otherwise it's, I cannot really say how I do. It's a process. There's always an answer coming up. Some people, you know, I did something called Ad Lucem or Ad Lucem with two vocalists singing in Latin, and how did I come up with that idea? I can hardly remember. It just came to me. Fascinating in the Latin, in reading the Latin language, trying to understand it. And then I just suddenly one day heard, and maybe fascinated medieval music, simplicity, and writing simple two-part writing for two voices, since I like voices. So maybe it's about when you get an idea that is seemingly a little strange, let's say three tubas. Oh, too much work, and only low register, and they don't intonate. No, keep the idea a little and see, oh, maybe it is possible. What can I do to make this weird combination come alive? And who shall play? And so surprising ideas probably comes to all of us, but not leave them too fast. See, is this possible? Can I trust this weird intuition of mine? Or
yeah, because the fear that we have, maybe it's fear, maybe it's a doubt or whatever, it comes in too quickly to judge interesting, unorthodox, new ideas.
And I realize now when we talk about it, there's one more thing that makes you throw away fascinating artistic ideas. It's practicalities. Possibly also money. Oh, shit. Two harps in my band. No, that's not possible. We don't have a car big
enough.
We're
never, exactly. We're never going to be able to travel.
Etc. Yeah. And you drop the idea. While if you were, I don't know, world famous or more daring or more convinced, you would start thinking, how on earth can I bring two harps in the band? Well, I have to talk to some harp players, and maybe they know, oh, I have sponsorship, they drive me everywhere, blah blah blah, but you have to investigate this.
That's true. I often like to think from the perspective of a perfect world. In your perfect musical world, what would it be? And then there's more freedom for the ideas to
and
flourish.
That's part of being an artist, trying to go beyond everyday routines, your own everyday routines, trying to go beyond considering practicalities, etc., and be a little crazy sometimes. And reality catches you anyway. But you can at least compose the piece. And so I think that can often stop us, because our experience tells us how much trouble besides art there will be realizing this project, and how much money do we have to apply for to put this band together. And oh no, I call my old band again. So that's a challenge to handle.
Well, I wish you all the best for the new thing.
Thank you.
I'll be listening.
No.
because you're a
big...
I will
do my best when you listen.
You're a big influence on me, and I'm happy
that
we got the chance to play.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to another chance.
Chance, please.
Yeah.
Just contact me. This was
all right.
Thank you for...
Thanks for doing this. Yeah, that was a big pleasure, and I'm happy we got to do it.